Primary Reaction Chamber.
Precopa Ramindos on Earth.
Time.
Initial reaction at T-minus 30.
Fuel slug in place.
Stand by for injection.
Capsule breach now.
Reaction commencing.
Containment field hold to 3.14 degrees of time. Initial chambers crossing to capacity.
Can we hold it?
What's happening?
Critical mass.
Hold on! Mind spike!
I'm Winston Crutchfield, your host for the Critical Mass Podcast here at Critical Press Media. Thanks for joining me today. Got kind of a stream of consciousness thing going on for you today. I'm going to talk about some movies and books that I've been reading. I'm going to talk about the new Alice in Wonderland from Tim Burton and Johnny Depp. I'm going to talk about Percy Jackson and the Olympians. And then we're going to visit Garth Nix and the Keys to the Kingdom. Don't have any interviews. It's just me ranting and raving. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about the new benefit project. Part of Compassion 365 over at the Christian New Media Group. In fact, I've got a little clip that'll that'll keep me from doing exactly this. Critical Press Media is committed to publishing 2 books annually for the purpose of raising money and awareness for selected charities. This presents an ideal opportunity for amateur writers, writing enthusiasts, and students to get professional, critical feedback on their writing and possibly even publish a story. No submission will be turned away unread.
Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did you see the hungry and fed you, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me." From the book of Matthew, chapter 25, verses 34 through 40.
Critical Press Media's first benefit project for 2010 will be part of Compassion 365, the year-long campaign by the Christian New Media Group to raise awareness and funds for Compassion International. We are looking for original fiction by new and upcoming authors with a passion for emotional storytelling, thought-provoking and well-reasoned essays where critical reasoning is brought to bear on the topic, and riveting news articles documenting the impact of suffering on humanity and the efforts of individuals and relief organizations. Manuscripts suitable for the project will be anywhere from 200 to 10,000 words in length. They'll belong to any genre or style and use an act of compassion as a key element of the manuscript.
Dad, what is an act of compassion?
The passage in Matthew defines 6 states of being wherein an act of compassion performed as ministry to another is actually service rendered to the Lord. Hunger, thirst, alienation, vulnerability, sickness, and imprisonment. A manuscript ideally suited to this project will treat one of these conditions as a central element or theme and demonstrate the effect of these conditions both on the afflicted and on their deliverer. Don't second-guess your story. Send it in and let us read it. Deadline for manuscript submission is June 1st, 2010. No new manuscript submissions will be accepted after June 1st. Manuscripts should be submitted in the body of an email or as an email attachment to WinstonC@criticalpressmedia.com with the words "manuscript submission" in the subject line. Please include a brief synopsis of your submission and a few lines about you personally in the body of the email. Remember, we're looking for information, not ad copy. All submissions will be read by the editorial staff at Critical Press Media, and authors will receive a detailed response about their manuscript. If the manuscript is suitable for the project, editors will continue to work with the author until the project is complete. All authors published in the final project will receive a copy of the final book in print and in ebook formats.
Critical Press Media is not associated with Compassion International, but we desire the benefit book to reflect the core values of that organization. More information may be found in the submission section at criticalpressmedia.com. Much to do has been made over the new Tim Burton and Johnny Depp film, Alice in Wonderland, from Walt Disney Pictures. Coming from this creative team, you might expect something on the order of Edward Scissorhands or Sweeney Todd, or any number of films that these two have collaborated on. Burton and Depp do conspire to bring a certain dark fantasy appeal to their version of the Alice in Wonderland story. However, on one hand, this is very much like every other Tim Burton film you've ever seen. The palette of colors is very muted. It's very pastel in certain places where he wishes to emphasize drab, and very vibrant and bright in others where he wishes to emphasize the vibrancy of life, I guess. But there are a few things that you should know going into the film. Number one, primarily, the 3D effects are rather an afterthought. The movie does not suffer for their absence and really does not benefit from their inclusion. And as to the story, well, chances are good if you're like every other American modern person on the planet, you've probably never read the original adventures of Alice in Wonderland and Through the Looking Glass. Probably your only exposure to this has been kind of a cultural osmosis from various cartoons, especially the Disney cartoon would be the most famous. But a number of lesser productions have been made, both cartoon and live action, of the Alice in Wonderland and the Through the Looking Glass stories. So chances are good you've never read these books. And Burton makes blends the two stories together to two stories which are actually very, very different, with different things to say and quite different settings. Burton blends them both together to tell his own sequel of sorts to these children's stories, turning them from children's stories with a satirical edge that adults would find relevant into purely dark fantasy that is mostly unsuitable for children, which teenagers will find boring, and I don't suppose it is the kind of material that would appeal to the modern teenagers, and put it that way, and which the average adult looking for an entertaining dark fantasy is likely to find forgettable. And at the same time, Burton, ever the master of subtext, makes many of these elements work to his advantage to make some pointed comments on the decline of the aristocracy, on the reversal of societal norms, especially in regards to the character of Alice. And of course, what I find to be the film's only real redeeming quality, the confirmation that wonder and the mystical and all those things that bring joy and bring a sense of grandeur to the universe are in fact real and are in fact out there. And along the way, he makes a number of comments about stages of life and cycles of life. I mean, we have a very pointed scene where the caterpillar undergoes a metamorphosis and later appears as a butterfly, kind of on the nose,
as we see Alice, you know, begin the film as the caterpillar go into her own, you know, withdraw into her own little chrysalis of denial, and then emerge as the triumphant Joan of Arc figure and butterfly. But all of this is really kind of incidental to a film which is at its heart purely a dark, fantastic story. And the attempts to add literary weight are just that. They are attempts to add literary weight without affecting the substance of the story itself. Tim Burton, of course, is best known for his dark treatment of innocent themes. And as darkly themed and as darkly toned as the content of this story is, I do have to point out that the entirety of that perceived darkness comes not from an inherent contemplation of the condition of humanity, or of the horror of an abstract universe, or of any number of things that may truly can be considered dark and grim and horrible. Rather, Burton, as is his pattern, derives all of his darkness from a corruption of things which are innocent. And nowhere is this more pointedly observed than in the case of the Mad Hatter and the March Hare, the characters of which in the original stories were simply caricatures of adult behavior as seen through the eyes of a child. And in Tim Burton's revisited Alice in Wonderland, not only are we treated to a flashback where this is not really the case, where these caricatures are not presented as such, but for the duration of the film, the March Hare is presented as a raving lunatic who has been destabilized by the oppression of society. And the Mad Hatter is a broken individual who presents a kind of Tyler Durden duality, wherein one part of him attempts to conform to the madness of Underland, and the other part is in full-fledged grim, bloody rebellion. And Depp, of course, portrays both of these masterfully. And the result is very, very disturbing. But it is not disturbing for what it is, but it is disturbing rather because it takes imagery and iconography that one associates with childhood and one associates with innocence, and presents these as being corrupted by society and being corrupted by the environment around them. And this is done throughout the film, with the sole exception being the caterpillar, who is able to transcend the corruption that has taken hold of Underland. And yes, that is Underland and not Wonderland. Wonderland was a contrivance by Alice. She called the place Wonderland because she could not understand what it was. And throughout the film, when the denizens speak of it, they refer to it as Underland. And of course, this carries just along with it a whole host of subtext. I mean, it's not Underland solely because it is under the earth in a hollow earth kind of atmosphere. But it, of course, is also that land which is under our own societal contrivances. In any event, I find the Alice in Wonderland movie to have a number of things to say. I find it to be very well constructed, both from a filmmaking standpoint. Burton certainly knows what he's doing. I mean, the action and the color palette and the filmography and everything about the film is presented in a professional manner. He's also got quite a lot to say from a literary standpoint, from the standpoint of not satire, but more pointed social commentary. To call a film like this, or any of Burton's work, satire, would not do true satirist justice for the satirist takes what is inherently serious and makes fun of it. And Burton approaches things from exactly the opposite angle, taking things that are and ought to be inherently lighthearted and innocent and corrupting them. On the whole, though, I quite enjoyed Alice in Wonderland. I didn't find it to be spectacularly appealing in any particular sense. However, I will likely see it again when it hits DVD, Blu-ray. And I look forward especially to seeing what kind of special features they put on there. And I'm kind of hoping for some commentaries from the writing and creative team, rather than the usual "this is how we did the special effects" kind of thing. So, Alice in Wonderland, I enjoyed it. I think you would too. I'm going to take a short break, then we're coming back, and I'm going to talk for a bit about Percy Jackson and the Olympians.
Are you just watching?
Do you enjoy watching movies? The cool effects, the interesting characters, the explosions.
Yeah, you like the explosions, admit it.
Well, we do too.
But sometimes it pays to approach Hollywood media with a healthy dose of critical thinking.
Join me, Daniel Lewis.
And Eve Franklin.
As we discuss our favorite movies.
And share critical thinking for the entertained Christian.
So visit areyoujustwatching.com to subscribe.
And don't just watch.
Percy Jackson got his big break in a new feature film, also from Walt Disney Pictures. And the wife and I went out to see this. She had been excited about some of the previews and picked up the first novel to read. Of course, I'd seen the books in the bookstore for quite a while, and every time I went to pick up the Lightning Thief and start reading the Olympian series, which I'd heard good things about, and I know that Rick Riordan is a fantastic and talented writer in his own right, but it's just one of those that I never quite got around to. So we picked up the books for the wife, and she read the first novel before we went to see the movie. I think she had actually finished the first two and a half at the time that we had gotten to go see the movie, but whatever. So we went to see the movie, and the comparison, most of the comparisons that you hear, put it upside along Harry Potter, call it a Harry Potter clone, and that kind of things. And I have to say that these comparisons are inherently unfair. Although Chris Columbus directed both, you know, both films, the first Harry Potter film and The Lightning Thief as well, they are in fact very, very different in substance. And I find this to be so dramatically the case that where one reviewer at Rotten Tomatoes commented, "Dutifully Harry Potter it begins and dutifully Harry Potter it ends," I find that to be exactly the opposite case. But I don't really want to talk about Harry Potter. I want to talk about Percy Jackson. The movie, as its own entity, is substantially different from the books. The book, I think, if it were filmed as it is written, I think it would make a very poor movie. They took the story, they took the basic idea of the story for the movie, and they made it into something that I can sit down and enjoy watching for 2 hours or so. And without the detailed background and exposition necessary to a proper enjoyment of books. And having said that, I quite enjoyed it. I thought it was a great, fun film. It is an adventure film. It's an action film. No apology is made for that. And no real attempt at anything deeper is made in the process, except for a few comments about the nature of the Olympian gods and how that reflects on human nature. So that I thought was, you know, was well placed and subtle, and not overbearing at all. Certainly not as on the nose as Alice in Wonderland was. So I quite enjoyed The Lightning Thief, and I am certainly hoping that they, I haven't looked, but I'm certainly hoping that they carry on with the series, because I would certainly like to see the Sea of Monsters make it to the big screen. Now the books by Rick Riordan, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, I found to be quite a different animal. I read through The Lightning Thief in, I don't know, half a week or so, 3-4 days, and quite enjoyed it. The story is about a young boy who finds out that he is a demigod, that he is the son of Poseidon. And if you fear that's a spoiler, well, maybe, possibly, if you've not seen the trailer for the movie and don't know anything about it, then I apologize. But that revelation is not one of the large ones in the book. It's a mystery for the first part of it, but it does not remain so very long. It's not really a point of tension. So Percy Jackson finds out that he is a demigod, the son of Poseidon, and then spends the rest of the series learning how to fit into this world that is finally actually beginning to make sense to him. He has spent his entire life up till now not fitting in the mundane world. He is ADHD, he's dyslexic. He feels out of place in a world that is alien and hostile, and just in all ways perfectly captures the way I remember feeling about the world when I was age, you know, 12 to 16, which is the range of books. It was a strange place. I didn't understand it. It didn't understand me. I felt like it was hostile to me and to everything I did. And Rick Riordan just captures this so perfectly in the Percy Jackson series that the character of Percy is instantly relatable and instantly likable. And the books, his adventures through the books, he is very proactive. He does what he does because he feels that he needs to do it, because he feels that it's the right thing to do, and most importantly, because it is something that needs to be done. And the books on a larger scale is all about Percy growing up and taking responsibility for his actions, bearing responsibility for other people's actions, and learning to find his place in a world that was formerly hostile to him for reasons that he didn't understand. But now he understands it, and he learns to deal with the hostility. And one of the greatest triumphs of the book deals with the matter of prophecy. And unlike the Harry Potter books, where the prophecy is a big mystery, prophecies are used in the Percy Jackson books in a much more direct way, in a much more Greek way. You have the big one that carries the series, and you don't get to find out entirely what that is until the end of until the last Olympian, until book 5. But that's okay. You get a treatment throughout the books. I think every prophecy has its, or every book has its own, prophecy that carries it through. And in a very Greek way, these things really don't ever end well and aren't ever meant to end well. So that, while you've got, so Percy spends his first book figuring things out. And, he spends the next 3 books trying to figure out how to work around it. The subject of prophecy is very key here. He spends the lightning thief learning where to fit in, learning how his new world works. And it's a great journey of adventure. It's very much the hero's journey. The journey of Odysseus, that kind of thing. And then the next 3 books he spends attempting to save his friends from their own dire prophecies. And of course, in the best Greek tradition, every time Percy tries to circumvent the prophecy, he just ensures he just makes things worse. Put it that way. He just increases the tragedy that is going to result from the fulfillment of this prophecy. And it's something that Percy learns to accept. Rick Riordan makes no bones about the mortality of his characters. The characters die off at a phenomenal rate. The books are presented as the world is presented as a dangerous place for demigods, and that's true. And in fact, book 5 treats us to all-out war as everything that he's been leading up to comes to pass. But the biggest triumph I've found in the Percy Jackson and the Olympians series is the character and the growth of Percy. So that Percy spends the first book learning about his world. He spends books 2, 3, and 4 trying to find a place to fit in to his world. And he spends book 5 taking that place and making it his own. So that by the end of book 5, Percy Jackson is not the victim of prophecy. He is not the tool of the gods. He is not anything other than a young man, no longer a boy, who for the first time is in control of his own destiny and is able to make his way in a world where he understands his responsibilities and is able to fulfill them. And I find this to be just a fantastically mature way to treat the evolution of this character in the series. I was so very impressed. And nowhere is this more eloquently expressed than in the way that Percy learns to treat prophecy. So that by the end of, by the time book 5 rolls around, we get a character who, rather than spend the entire book attempting to circumvent this prophecy of doom and gloom, Percy would rather attempt to work things out so that prophecies, which he has learned by now, can't really be diverted or anything like, can't be circumvented. But rather, Percy spends the entirety of book ensuring that the prophecy will come to pass in the most dire way possible, and that he himself will bear
the focus will bear the most focus constant, you know, will be the focus of all of these grim happenings. And while that may at first glance seem to be incredibly self-serving or egotistical, Percy never goes down that road. His purpose is not to increase his statue or his stature or his own legend or anything like that. Percy's purpose is to preserve his friends and loved ones. And if he has to suffer so that other people may live, then Percy is perfectly willing to do this. And more than anything else, I find that self-sacrificial attitude to be the deliverance of the Percy Jackson books, that raises them from the level of well-written, entertaining adventure stories to works of literature that I would be happy for my children to read when they get old enough to really enjoy it. My daughter is 8, and she has started reading. She's made about 6 chapters into The Lightning Thief, but quite frankly, the book is not about puppies, and so she's not as interested as she might otherwise be. Percy Jackson and the Olympians, I recommend them without reservation, without hesitation. These are phenomenal books. They should be read. I think I devoured all 5 books in less than a month. The Sea of Monsters in particular, I picked it up Saturday morning, and I finished it before Saturday night, and they're just captivating books that paint a picture of a world where magic and wonder are possible and where you can be involved. And I find these to be so different and so refreshing from the self-absorbed Harry Potter books, where not only is Harry Potter's world different than ours, it's also better than ours. Where in direct contrast to that, the Percy Jackson books present a world that is real, and a world that is ours, and that a world that reveals to us the things that are going on behind the scenes that we wouldn't normally see or wouldn't pay attention to. And just, they make the world a larger place without making it any less, without making it any more drab. The world of Percy Jackson and the Olympians is a world of grandeur and awe and majesty. And it's I wouldn't want to be a demigod in it. It's far too dangerous for my taste. But it is definitely a world where adventure is out there, and where these cosmic supernatural beings bring a sense of greater substance to it. And while I'm on the subject, the issue of religion is not ever really addressed in the Percy Jackson books as such. There is a brief comment in The Lightning Thief where when Percy is introduced to the concept of the Olympian gods, he says, "So God is real." And he is quickly corrected by Chiron, the mentor character. He says, "No, not God. We're not talking about metaphysics. We're talking about the gods." And the gods are not presented as divine beings, although that word is used many times, but rather as elemental beings. And this is very much in keeping with the Greek
the Greek traditions. So, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, fantastic fantasy literature. I recommend it for all ages, without reservation. It's as good as anything on the market, and better than most. I would recommend Percy Jackson over Harry Potter. Any day of the week. Just good stuff. Alright, well, I am pushing, better than half an hour now, and I really hadn't wanted to go that long. But if I haven't said it already, I really enjoyed the Percy Jackson books, and I think you should too. I've also been reading Garth Nix's The Keys to the Kingdom. I finished Mr. Monday and Grim Tuesday, and by the time you hear from me again, I will likely have burned through one or two more of the seven books in the series. And I hope to be bringing you a review of those. I've quite enjoyed them, and I think they have a lot to say. And you know what? Before I get too far down that road, I'm just gonna stop here. I'm gonna leave you with a closing tidbit, and then just say stick around next week. You will be getting a podcast next week, and ought to be something special.
The Yak is back.
More discussion,
more fun, more interviews,
and even more competitions.
More than you can handle.
Download us at iTunes
or subscribe at classicyak.org.
You can also find us at Podcast Alley
and other good podcast retailers.
Batteries included.
May contain nuts.
Email at mindspike@criticalpressmedia.com.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license.